I'm not dependent on a single income stream that comes from my employer. I think a lot of us learned, whether it was the Great Recession or even like the 2020 COVID lockdowns, being dependent on one stream of income is very risky. This show is brought to you today by Lightbulb Podcasting. Are you a busy professional that needs to get more time back in their schedule? If you are a podcaster like me, you have enough on your plate. Why not outsource your podcast production? From editing, show notes, keywords, scheduling, volume balancing, and editing, and creating audiograms, podcast production is another job in and of itself. That's why I use Lightbulb Podcasting. Get phenomenal support at an affordable price while you concentrate on growing your brand. Go to www.lightbulbpodcasting.com today to schedule an introductory call. Put your content in the spotlight.
Are you tired of the 9-to-5 lifestyle? Do you want more freedom to do what you want, when you want it, without sacrificing your current income? Then this is the show for you. Every week, we dive into John's journey towards financial freedom and everything he has learned since 2014. Real estate investing, cryptocurrency, stocks, private lending, foreign residency, tax saving strategies, infinite banking, assets protection, and much more. Now, here is your host, the founder of the Wealth and Freedom Nexus, John Rickgarn.
All right, and welcome back to another great episode of the Wealth and Freedom Nexus podcast. Today, kind of going a little off script, no guest interviews today. No big topic, shall we say, you know, not talking about wholesaling or, you know, whole life insurance or foreign development or foreign real estate or anything like that. Basically, just kind of wanted to do a quick recap, shall we say, a mid-year review, kind of some of my own thoughts, answering some, you know, questions, emails, messages I've gotten. So, we'll just kind of run into it. Like I said, this is the Wealth and Freedom Nexus podcast. This is the first time joining in. Be sure to hit that subscribe button so you never miss an episode. For all those that have listened to my episode from New York City to obviously Marshall, Minnesota, where I'm based, all the way to Riyadh, Saudi Arabia. That one actually surprised me last couple of weeks when I was looking at the download statistics. But as we crossed or having many thousands of downloads across six continents. Just again, thank you for all your support, your reviews, your subscribes, and suggestions to make this a better show and what you'd like to see and what you'd like to learn. So as this is coming out, this is coming right after the July 4th, Independence Day from Britain that we started here in the United States way back in 1776, where basically the founding fathers said, you know what, we're going to be an independent nation. We are not going to take orders from the King of Britain, and we're just going to keep on building our own nation and building a new country, so to speak. And I just, you know, was kind of starting to thinking of, you know, what's your Independence Day? What's your Freedom Day, if you will, from your day job? Are you slaving away at a job that's you maybe just tolerate at best, or, you know, hate at worst, and maybe you're just sticking around because you're, you know, fearful of, you know, a big change, or fearful of a career change, or, you know, maybe you got those lovely golden handcuffs that everyone talks about. Maybe it's a, you know, a pension plan you don't want to see go away. Maybe it's healthcare benefits. Obviously, healthcare, along with, well, everything else is going up in price in 2022 and probably for the foreseeable future. So, you know, if you got some of those benefits, and some people call them golden handcuffs, you know, right, wrong, or indifferent, that makes someone maybe just kind of want to stay in a job that maybe they just don't like. Now, for myself personally, December 31st, 2030, that is going to be my financial freedom day or financial independence day. Everything's still on track. Obviously, you know, plans change. If it's sooner, great. But that was just kind of a, you know, I don't want to say arbitrary, but was just a realistic goal, I would say, of when I wanted to be done, you know, really have financial freedom, have enough passive income that would exceed all my monthly expenses as well as my wife's expenses. And, you know, since obviously that would be New Year's Eve, hopefully I'll be celebrating that somewhere tropical. December here in Minnesota gets pretty cold and snowy. So I don't know, maybe, Puerto Rico, maybe Belize, Costa Rica. I don't know. There's a lot of places I want to see. So, you know, who knows? Hopefully that's plan will come to fruition and that will happen on schedule. Now, technically, like I said, December 31st, 2030, that is more of my financial independence day, just where my passive income exceeds my monthly expenses. Like I've said, my tagline has always been financial freedom, one bill at a time. I always kind of gave a, you know, kind of the Netflix example. Everyone seems to have a Netflix subscription, you know, at whatever plan you have, at $15 a month, $20 a month, and just kind of starting to think, it's like, well, what's an investment I can make that pays for that Netflix subscription or whatever it is that pays for that per month? And you set up a passive income stream, whether that's from a rental, a syndication, interest from notes, maybe stock dividends. You know, if you're in oil stocks or master limited partnerships, those have been doing pretty well in 2022 and probably will be in the foreseeable future. So like I said, just kind of working backwards, here's an investment, whatever that may be. And whether it's $15 a month, $20 a month, come up with an investment that pays for that bill, whatever that is. And that bill is taken care of by passive income. And then you just, you know, move on to the next one. Like I said, financial freedom, one bill at a time. This current time, I'm actually self-employed, so I still have a lot of active income, but as well as passive income too. September 3rd, 2019 was actually my exit from the W-2 world. Corporate sales job, sold copiers, was actually in the industry for just about 12 years. And I could go on a whole nother podcast or tirade about that, but I think everyone kind of can, you know, reflect or maybe empathize, you know, having a boss that you don't care about or higher ups or, you know, corporate BS, so to speak. And in this case, the last company I worked for, we were owned by a private equity company. So, you know, if there's a way to pinch pennies and squeeze blood from a stone, they will find a way to do that. So with that, kind of why I'm mentioning that of my Financial Freedom Day, Financial Independence Day, in conjunction with this podcast, just a little heads up, I will be launching a new YouTube show in 2 months called Screw the W-2. I'll have more on that later. If you follow me on Instagram, Twitter, obviously my newsletter, more little, you know, sneak peeks or blurbs will be coming out about that. But essentially it'll be more of a collection of interviews, people I've networked over the years, you know, from as here in Marshall to the East Coast, the West Coast, and even different countries that I've networked with that, you know, for whatever reason, they just hated their last W-2 job. And they said, screw the W-2, screw the 9-to-5. I'm going into business myself. I'm starting a business. I'm going to become an investor or whatever the case may be. And obviously just kind of share their, you know, the pros and cons, the challenges they've experienced, and, you know, words of wisdom to anyone else out there, maybe feel stuck in their job. I was that way many years ago. And I, you know, it took a, shall we say, a big leap of faith and a lot of planning to get to the point where I was comfortable. It's like, all right, you know, I'm walking away from a career that I literally spent one third of my life in, was pretty good at it. I mean, I, you know, made a decent salary and good commission, great benefits, but, you know, just, you know, there just tends to be a time that you realize, you know, there's more to life. I'm always a big believer of don't defer your life. So I just want something more. And I said, you know, that's it. And I'm going to see what happens. And here I am 3 years later. You know, like I said, I'm an investor. I'm an educator. I'm a realtor. Do real estate closings, little side jobs, continue to grow my passive income portfolio, you know, right size my investments from syndications to single family home rentals, and just, you know, keep working on that eventual goal to have the passive income exceed my monthly expenses for my financial freedom date.
We'll be right back.
Money is all around us, and we think about it more than almost every other aspect of our lives. But how can we make more of it, and what's our drive for building wealth beyond just the numbers in our bank account? Join us on the Make More podcast as our host Matt Heslin brings to you a dynamic lineup of experts in the world of investing, business, health, and beyond. Together, they unpack the secrets to not just surviving, but thriving in today's economy. It's about more than just wealth. It's about crafting life experiences, seizing opportunities, and building a legacy. Subscribe now to the Make More with Matt Heslin podcast and join us every week for new expert insights and inspiration.
So with that, we'll just kind of stop there on the, you know, Financial Independence Day, a little bit of what's coming on, coming up with the Screw the W-2 show, and really just kind of wanted to touch base on a number of topics. You know, obviously you've probably seen the news, you've messaged me, you've commented on some of my posts. Well, let's just start with crypto. I think that's on the forefront of everyone's minds. June of 2021, Bitcoin hit a high of about $63,000, $65,000 per Bitcoin. So, I mean, if you got into it, well, anytime before then, you obviously did very well. If you're one of the early adopters, whether it was a penny of Bitcoin, a dollar of Bitcoin, $100 of Bitcoin, you know, run up to 65,000 was definitely nice. And since then, it's plummeted about 67%. More so in the last couple of weeks here, early summer, we've seen various exchanges implode, shall we say. Luna, Terra, supposed to be a stable coin, that pretty much just imploded, and millions of dollars were lost there. Billions were actually lost on the total market capitalization, really across the board, whether it's Bitcoin, Bitcoin Cash, Ethereum, Litecoin, you can just about name any cryptocurrency, has seen a big downward push. So, you know, obviously I don't have a crystal ball. A lot of people are asking, you know, hey, what should we do? Where is it going? Time to cash out, buy more. What do you do? Just my thoughts. Cryptocurrency, I'm going to say not so much cryptocurrency, but the blockchain technology is still very much in its infant stage. I kind of look back to it with the internet that I grew up with in the early 90s. Believe it or not, there was a time that we did not have internet going to our homes. There was a time we didn't have smartphones that we could Google something on the fly or ask Siri for directions to the nearest movie theater, whatever the case may be. And, you know, I kind of look back in the 90s and for any millennial or Gen Z listening to this, there was a internet browser called Netscape that I don't think anyone's heard of right now. And that was kind of the big thing back in the 90s. You know, that was how people browsed the internet. And the internet was very, very entry level, rudimentary, shall we say, back then. You know, you did not have these flashy graphics. You did not have all these new programming languages. You didn't stream Netflix through your computer. You basically just pulled up a web page that had text, pictures. You might be able to do some downloads, and these weren't super fast downloads. This was off the 56K modem that made all these screeching, scratching Bugs Bunny cartoons sounds as I was logging in. And like I said, with the internet, you know, obviously gave way to the dot-com boom and essentially bust. You know, pretty much any company out there could put .com and after their name, and it just like quadrupled their market capitalization. And, you know, there was the infamous pets.com and all these, you know, online companies that were going to be a huge disruptor to the space. And, you know, the NASDAQ just went up and up and up, almost parabolic in the late 90s. And then around the turn of the century, just completely crashed down. You can just even Google the dot-com bust. And obviously a lot of names, you know, completely folded. One company you may have heard of, Amazon, that crashed. And I say crashed relatively speaking, about 90% in value from where it debuted back in 96, 97, I think it was. And, you know, Cisco took a huge dive. Microsoft took a huge dive. Netscape obviously isn't around anymore. Yahoo used to be the primary search engine back in the day. Now that was acquired by Verizon for next to nothing a couple of years ago. Like I said, Netscape died off, but Amazon and Google are still around, and they grew to be pretty big power players in the industry. And now they're part of the S&P 500. So, you know, the whole cryptocurrency blockchain, it's still very speculative, still very much in its infancy stage. You know, keep in mind the whole blockchain, it's meant as a decentralized ledger and more of a, how I put it, like a self-auditing platform per se. So if you think about how the blockchain works, where it's essentially numerous computers connected over the internet around the world, performing complex math equations to basically verify on multiple levels that, you know, whatever the case may be, John signed over property ABC to Bill on this date. All the algorithms and mathematical equations are put in and verifies, yep, this transaction was done. You know, again, whether it was a transfer of a property, a smart contract, or, you know, sending Bitcoin from one wallet to another, which can happen in, you know, as little as a half hour, which, you know, sometimes seems a long time. But if you think about it, we're still in a very antiquated system that if I want to wire money, I just, you know, pay $35 to my bank to wire it, you know, domestically, internationally, it might even be more, and then has to get the Federal Reserve involved. And then they have to, you know, go through all their checks and balances and make sure we're not laundering money and give approval and yada, yada. And if you're lucky, it might, you know, get done in 2 hours, but now, for crying out loud, this is the 21st century. We have technology available that I should be able to send money anywhere, anywhere in the world and have it verified and completed in less than a half an hour. So that's kind of where the foundation of the blockchain technology comes from, where it's not just a cryptocurrency, not just a, you know, like I said, whether it's Bitcoin or Ethereum, can really be kind of a platform where other applications, other contracts, software can be developed on, very much like how the internet was back in the 90s. So I, you know, like I said, I don't have a crystal ball. I think blockchain is here to stay. I mean, everything from, you know, right, wrong, or indifferent, but Federal Reserves and World Banks are looking at doing their own digital coins. China's done their own digital coin. Smart contracts are starting to get more and more popular on the Ethereum network. So the actual technology itself, just like the internet, I think is here to stay. Now, can I predict in the future what Bitcoin is going to be? No. There's obviously a lot of altcoins out there. Many of them, probably 99% of them, aren't going to survive. So, you know, obviously proceed with caution. Don't invest with anything more than you can afford to lose. I still have Bitcoin. I still have a little bit of Ethereum, a small amount of Litecoin, more just for speculative purposes. And that's pretty much it on my end. And the bulk of what I have there is actually in my Roth IRA. So yes, I look at it more speculative. If all the cryptocurrencies just completely crashed, went down to zero, you know, yeah, it would, you know, wouldn't be fun by any means, but, you know, it isn't going to make me destitute or anything like that. So I'm very conservative on it. I only invest money that I can afford to lose. Obviously I have, you know, branched out to other mechanisms, whether it's earning interest on my crypto or even invested in a Bitcoin mining fund that I have in my self-directed Roth account. So like I said, crypto is still a little bit speculative. I personally kind of see, you know, the Bitcoin, the Ethereum, those staying around, maybe making some changes, maybe some other forks, but kind of that central technology still being in play and still being in use for, you know, years and decades to come. There might be another new altcoin that comes up that maybe takes off, you know, whether Bitcoin is going to be the Google from 1990s, or if it's going to be the Netscape from the 1990s, you know, that remains to be seen. But the technology, some of it's still going to be around. You know, proceed with caution. Don't bet the farm on it. Technology is still very new, very much developing, but I think it is here to stay. And obviously there's going to be ups and downs and peaks and valleys as we move forward. Kind of in conjunction with that, as you may have noticed here, time of recording this here in June, don't think July is going to be much different, but mortgage rates, interest rates, don't remember the exact numbers, but I saw earlier that the mortgage rates over the last week went up by the highest percentage amount, or the went up the highest amount since like 1987. So it wasn't too long ago, even earlier this year, you know, a lot of mortgage rates are still in the 3-4%. Now, you know, typically you're looking at a 30-year mortgage, primary home, probably about 5.75 to about 6.5, give or take in there. Obviously a lot to do with, you know, what the banks are going to offer. You can buy down the rate, which I've done in the past as well. But, you know, at the end of the day, 3%, obviously a lot cheaper than 6%. And if you are looking to be a, you know, first time home buyer, move up, or even buy an investment property like I like to do, you know, the 6% versus, you know, 3-4%, that can make a big ding on cash flow. If you're pre-approved for, say, $1,200 a month for a mortgage payment, a lot of times mortgage providers will give pre-qualification letters, and that is usually based on income. Their DTI that Mr. and Mrs. Smith, they can afford to spend whatever, $1,200 a month on their mortgage. Well, you work that backwards, $1,200 a month at a 6% interest rate versus a 3% interest rate, that is going to put a big crimp on how much home you can buy. The irony or paradox with this is, while you think, okay, rates are going up, this will be the real estate crash we've all been waiting for. Well, inventory is still very, very low. You know, nationwide, we're still sitting around about 500,000 homes for sale at any given time. Population continues to grow. Obviously, the millennial generation, myself included, Gen Z, growing up, graduating college, they'll need a place to live wherever that is. And there just is not the inventory to keep up with demand. We've had a big lag on inventory ever since the Great Recession, when a lot of home builders went out of business or changed careers. We were overbuilt at that time. You may have seen the movie The Big Short, where the guys are walking around in, I think it was Miami, Florida, if I remember right. And there's like this huge development, you know, 50, 100 homes, and maybe 10 people are living there. A bunch of them were either abandoned or new builds with no one moving in. And now we got the opposite effect. There's a huge, huge, huge demand. But there just isn't the inventory to be a balanced market. You know, in realtor lingo, a balanced market is about 6 months worth of inventory. You know, we've been anywhere from about a month to 2 months of inventory. Instead of 500,000 homes for sale, we really need about 1.5 million homes on the market at any given time, coast to coast, you know, from San Francisco to Vesta, Minnesota, you know, and everywhere in between. So obviously, there's a crimp on the, you know, labor market, the construction market. We're still dealing with the supply chains. I don't foresee, you know, a crash in real estate. I do foresee maybe a little bit of a leveling off of prices, you know, maybe getting more to single digit appreciation numbers versus, you know, that 12 to 20% we've been seeing in the last 2, 3, 4 years. That said, a lot of builders are kind of changing their development plans. You might have seen the tiny home craze, or people just downsizing even too. So, you know, a lot of times people would want the huge McMansions, you know, 5 beds, 4 baths, 3-stall garage attached, and maybe just kind of simplifying the plans. You know, we'll probably see some more of that to come down the line. And back to the whole COVID thing, I mean, a lot of people were seeing or predicting a tsunami of foreclosures. Well, right, wrong, or indifferent, with a lot of legislation that was passed, there was, you know, debt forgiveness, forbearance, you know, eviction laws on the books. You couldn't evict tenants, even if they weren't paying a mortgage. They might just put the balance at the end of it, kind of like a balloon payment, and you got to skip a few payments in there. A lot of, you know, different things were done, again, right, wrong, or indifferent, by various legislation that really kind of kept the foreclosures at bay. And now that a lot of the, you know, lockdowns are lifted, or I think pretty much all of them are lifted, and we're kind of slowly going back to a new normal. Well, even with foreclosure proceedings, even in landlord-friendly states versus, you know, your Californias, your Illinois, it's going to take a while for that backlog to get through the court systems. They still need to have paperwork filed. They still need to get the sheriff involved. They need to, you know, do the eviction notice, notice of foreclosures, set up time for auctions. And obviously that takes time, and, you know, schedules are backed up. I mean, just to you know, give me an idea. A couple of weeks ago, I ended up breaking my glasses, so I kind of switched back to contacts. And, you know, a lot of people put off routine eye exams and appointments like that. MRIs were pushed off with COVID, you know, if it wasn't an emergency. So, like I said, I broke my glasses, and the first time they had to had available to get me in for an appointment was 2 weeks ago. That was actually this morning. So, you know, there's obviously been a big crunch on our supply chain, lockdowns lifted, but now there's just this huge backlog of appointments and schedules, and obviously foreclosures are in there. So I wouldn't anticipate a big, shall we say, tsunami of foreclosures. I do feel that there are more coming. I do think more banks are going to be working with some individuals, but I also think there's probably going to be some, you know, some short sales, some cash for keys, some foreclosure proceedings. But, you know, at the end of the day, we are still very, very undersupplied for housing. So even with the uptick in mortgage rates, I don't see a huge change to the overall housing market. We also have a lot better and more strict lending criteria. Again, back to one of my favorite movies, The Big Short, where they just, you know, made up documentation. They would make up, you know, ninja loans, no income, no job, no assets. Hey, you're pre-approved for a $400,000, 0% down, negative amortization loan. I mean, that's how crazy it was back in 2006 up until the Great Recession. Now it's, you know, larger down payments, more stringent criteria. All of this plays into an account where at the end of the day, there is a huge demand for housing, and we just don't have the supply to keep up with it. It still is going to take several years. It might even be, you know, back to my financial independence day, it might be about 2030 before we get to a truly balanced market again, you know, just with home construction, state of the market. And, you know, keep in mind, you know, when you hear about, you know, Lennar or any other, you know, company or local contractor building homes, and, you know, it takes them, whatever, 8 months to build a new home, or 12 months to build a new, whatever, 100 unit apartment complex, or this company built 800 homes in the last year, whatever the case may be. Take note that that's new inventory, but that's not exactly net new inventory. Again, back to time of this recording, you might have seen the pictures of the flooding in Yellowstone, where there was a large home that was literally swept away from the water. And so before that happened, that was a house that was on the market and or available, or a, you know, a house that was in inventory, so to speak. Obviously not anymore. Just the other day, I read in Boulder County, Colorado, I think year to date, here in 2022, over 1,000 homes have been lost to forest fires this year. So again, you know, a contractor, a big home builder, Lennar, American Homes for Rent, wherever the case may be, yeah, they may come in and maybe they have the staff, they have the supply, they have the labor, they have the supply chain, they have the contracts, they have everything lined up as a well-oiled machine. But, you know, you're still talking months to get a, you know, 500, 1,000 homes on the market. Forest fire, flood comes along, that might just within one fell swoop, within a matter of hours or days, that takes a 1,000 houses off the market. So really, you can't just look at the new permits, the new builds, the new developments going on. It really is a net new number. And that's, you know, obviously I've talked about, like, you know, fires and floods. There's also just buildings being condemned or uninhabitable. We also saw, you know, in the unfortunate condo building down in Florida. What I think it was that.
We'll be right back.
Insights into Teens, a podcast series exploring the issues and challenges of today's youth. Talking to real teens about real teen problems. Explore issues from braces to puberty, social anxiety to financial responsibility. Each week, we talk about the topics concerning today's youth. We look at how the issues affect teens, how to cope with these issues, and how parents, friends, and loved ones can help teens handle these challenges. Check out our video episodes on youtube.com/insightsintothings. Catch our audio versions on podcast.insightsintoteens.com or on the web at insightsintothings.com.
Was it the rebar or concrete or whatever just gave way, and then a whole, you know, multi-level condo complex just collapsed overnight. And there's additional housing units that are gone that were there one day and gone the next. So there's a lot of variables in play. And maybe just as one final maybe comparison I'll give you, for, like I mentioned, there's about 500,000 homes on the market at any given time. And at the tail end of the Great Recession, nationwide, there were 5 million homes just in foreclosure. That's not including new builds. That's not including homes on the market for rent or homes on the market for sale. Buyer's market, seller market, you know, that is just 5 million homes that were foreclosed on. That is 10 times the amount of total inventory. And again, that 500,000 that I mentioned before, that includes, you know, new builds, that includes resales, that does include a few, you know, foreclosures here and there. So again, demand is high, supply is low, and there's just no way flipping a switch to correct that anytime soon. So with that, you might be asking, okay, if interest rates, mortgage rates are going up, what can I do about it? Well, you know, you can also think of it as a borrower, but then think of it as an investor. As rates go up, you might want to start thinking about being on the lending side versus the borrowing side. For, you know, comparison purposes, back in the 80s, if anyone's ever bought a U.S. Treasury note or gotten those, you know, $50 savings bonds, you know, as a birthday gift from your grandparents, and, you know, maybe you got 1%, 2%, 3% interest, depending on when you got it. Back in the 80s, it wasn't uncommon to have double-digit returns on U.S. debt, basically. And for those that got them in the 80s and held on to them, they obviously turned out to be a very good investment. So, you know, as interest rates start to go up, you might want to look at, hey, is there a way to be on the lending side of the table versus the borrowing side? Like I mentioned, you know, on numerous blog posts, Lending Club was a fantastic platform that I worked with for many years until they retired the notes program. But there's a few others out there. Prosper is another one that comes to mind. Pier Street's another one that I've worked with, and even just a lot of through networking, various syndications, private lending. Another company I really enjoy working with, Ignite Funding. Invested with them a lot through my self-directed retirement accounts, and these are basically just with trust deeds. So, you know, instead of maybe 2-3% interest, if you're lucky, in a money market account or a stock or a CD, I'm not even sure if you can get that nowadays, even with the rising interest rates. You know, these trust deeds that are backed by, you know, real collateral, just like as a bank would underwrite a mortgage. You know, I've seen returns anywhere from 8-12% as interest rates go up. I wouldn't be surprised if 10% is more of the floor, especially for some like hard money lenders, private money lending. So, you know, just start to think about that. Is there a way to look at the borrowing side the lending side, not just the borrowing side? You can go back through my other podcast. I think it was episode 19 with Fred Moskowitz, who's bought and sold promissory notes and liens for many years. And there's definitely ways to purchase notes and promissory notes on the open market, you know, secondary market, and you can essentially be the bank and collect those interest payments. So as interest rates are going up, you can certainly look at that. And it's like, how can I benefit from what is going on? Likewise, if you have debt, you know, if you followed me for any amount of time, you'll know I'm not a big Dave Ramsey fan who views all debt as bad. There's good debt, there's bad debt, long-term debt, short-term debt, variable interest, fixed rate interest. Just to give you a comparison, back in 2020, I refinanced my primary home to a 2.375% interest rate. I don't think that's going to be showing anytime in the near future. And that is less than one-third of the official inflation rate, sitting at about 8.6% right now. So yeah, I'm just going to make that minimum set payment for the life of the loan. I have no intents to pay that off. I'm basically shorting the dollar. The interest rate is locked in for the term. It's not variable. It's not a credit card or anything like that. Even on investment properties, our condo in Arizona, Lock that in at 2.875, 30-year fixed mortgage. I'm not going to pay a penny extra on that thing. I'm just going to pay that month after month for the next 30 years. If anything, I'll probably look at putting a HELOC on and maybe to tap in some equity for some other investment properties. So if you have a low rate fixed interest debt, I would just leave it alone and, you know, make the minimum payments. And, you know, like I said, fixed is the key. Now, if it is a HELOC with a variable interest rate or especially credit cards, you know, car loans, student loans, et cetera, if those are, you know, 5%, 8%, 10%, you know, might want to look at some refinancing options. If there's any variability at all in some of those, you might want to look to a fixed rate personal loan. And whether it's a 5-year term, 7-year term, or like I mentioned before, 30-year term with mortgage, longer the term, and make sure that interest rate is fixed. Who knows where interest rates are going to be? I mean, back in the 80s, Volcker was the Fed chair, and he was determined to crush inflation, which he did, but it took about 15 to 20% Fed funds rate in order to do that. And if, you know, I was born in 1983, so I wasn't around the early 80s, but I still remember to this day of my aunt telling me, I think they were in Washington State, they got a mortgage in 1980 or 1981. I think it was 1981. They got a mortgage rate for 18%, and they thought that was the deal of the lifetime. And well, 18% isn't even, or that's higher than what a lot of my credit cards are right now. So obviously times are different. Times have changed. Rates are probably going to continue to go up. So, you know, just, you know, do the math. As Russell Gray always said, do the math and the math will tell you what to do. If it's a low interest rate that is fixed for the term of the loan, whether it's a 5-year personal loan, 10-year student loan, or 30-year mortgage, you know, just make the minimum payment and you're effectively shorting the dollar. Now, if it's a variable interest rate, like credit cards is the first thing that comes to mind, might want to switch those over to a 0% transfer offer, pay those off, you know, really just try to keep your interest as low as possible, fixed if at all possible, keep the term out as long as possible. And then kind of back to what my, at the beginning of this show, mentioning having those payments outsourced to a passive income stream. So, you know, do the math and math will tell you what to do. That said, kind of on my financial freedom journey, for those of you that have subscribed to my newsletter, I'm still looking at doing a large refinance in 2023. And, you know, rates could still be, you know, 7, 8, you know, even 9%. Who knows? Who knows what's gonna happen here in 2023. However, with a lot of the properties that I have, obviously, I've seen great appreciation over the last 6 years and various amortization tables left on them, anywhere from 9 years left to 25 years left, looking to pool all those together into one or two portfolio loans and doing a 30-year fixed rate and pulling cash out. A couple companies I've worked with, if you go back to my previous podcast, I had an interview with Timothy Hero. He's actually been a mortgage broker for a number of years, and he has access to lenders that do 30-year fixed non-QM loans that are cash out refinance up to 80% of the home or property's value. So if you have an investment property that, you know, just throw out numbers, maybe it's now worth $200,000 with the last couple of years of appreciation, and maybe right now you're sitting on a $100,000 mortgage. And obviously, like I said, rates are going up. You got to do the math, make sure the math makes sense. But at an 80% loan to value, a $200,000 property would mean that you could get $180,000 cash, or excuse me, $160,000 loan against it. That'd be a 80% loan to value cash out refinance. Well, if you take out a new $160,000 loan minus the $100,000 loan that you just paid off, well, that's $60,000 cash tax-free that you just pulled out that you can maybe invest for arbitrage. If you locked in at a low rate, you know, I still see some people getting between 5 and 6%. Again, inflation's about 8%. And let's say you're able to do a cash out refinance of your home, your investment properties, and whether it's $10,000 or $100,000, you know, put that money to work. Maybe I don't know, maybe buy some gold and put it in, silver bullion in Singapore or TDS, golden storage depository, where you'd also have access to a collateral line of credit against it. So if you ever needed money or access to that, you could basically take out a quick loan against it. No credit check, no application, no credit score dings, nothing. Maybe you want to recycle those funds. Maybe you have another investment property. Maybe there's one of my friends is doing this right now. They're doing a fix and flip of a home they purchased for $40,000. Needs a lot of work, but they're buying it for all cash and they're going to fix it up and flip it and take the proceeds and then roll that into another property. You know, whether you're taking $10,000 or $50,000 out, maybe that's a down payment on a, new investment property, a new build. So far on my podcast, we've had Mid-South home buyers. We have had Omni Key Realty down in Texas, which I've been pretty impressed with the level of craftsmanship on their new builds and where their numbers come in for rent to value. Obviously, Texas is a landlord-friendly state. If you want to go a little bit more diversified and maybe just want to hunt for, cash flow versus appreciation, give Marco Santarelli a call with Narada Real Estate. Him and his team, they have turnkey rentals everywhere from Oklahoma City, St. Louis, Philadelphia, Indianapolis, Indiana, Cleveland, Ohio, Utah. Those are just the ones that come off top of my head. So go back through the rest of my podcast. Got a lot of info on some turnkey properties, new builds, existing build that, again, like I said, just to evaluate your own circumstances, see what makes the most sense. And I am a big believer of always having a plan B and liquidity, whether that's a whole life insurance policy that you can tap into or a HELOC. Again, these are all topics that I've discussed on numerous episodes, from episode number 3 with Barry Brooksby, for instance. And, if I'm not going to say that we might, but I'd say there's a very good chance we probably will enter into a recession. Just look at your own income statement, look at your own balance sheet, maybe, pay some, high interest credit card debt off, maybe reallocate some resources. Maybe you have an investment property that's pretty much peaked in value. Maybe it's time to sell and do a 1031 exchange or a deferred sales trust like we had with Brett Swartz in episode 8, which at this recording, sorry, Brett, yeah, you've actually dropped to number 3. He was the number 1 most downloaded podcast for months on end. So sorry, Brett, but you're still in the top 5. But, look at a deferred sales trust, 1031 exchange, maybe look at some options to, put some money on the sidelines, look for the next deal, whether that's, maybe crypto goes down to, or Bitcoin goes down to $10,000. Maybe that's your what you're comfortable with for an entry level. And you just say, hey, I'm going to buy some Bitcoin now. Kind of like the old adage, when there's blood in the streets, look to buy then. So, like I said, everyone's situation is different. I can't say for sure what's going to happen in the months and years to come. I myself have lived through recessions. I've lived through the Great Recession. If you have liquidity, you have options, you have plan Bs in place, typically you're always going to come out ahead, or at least be able to even tread water, worst case scenario. Kind of back to, like I said, with passive income streams, I'm not locked in or I'm not dependent on a single income stream that comes from my employer. I think a lot of us learned, whether it was a Great Recession or even with the 2020 COVID lockdowns, being dependent on one stream of income is very risky, even though that's kind of what we've been taught to do since elementary school. Go and get a safe job, get a good job with good benefits, and then everything will be fine. And I think we found out that is not the case. And maybe just as a last note, kind of like I said, with recessions, with Fed's tightening of their policy, shall we say, raising of interest rates, quantitative tightening versus quantitative easing. And that's obviously a discussion for another time, but all those tend to play into a situation that if you are in need of capital, are in need of liquidity, are in need of funds, typically banks become a little bit more conservative, restrictive on what they're going to lend out, who they'll lend out to. And, you know, may even say, well, the 720 credit score is what we look for versus a 680. And maybe I had this happen back during the Great Recession. You may have a $10,000 credit limit that gets dropped to $5,000 or something. Maybe a HELOC line gets cut down or maybe even gets taken away if you haven't used it for a while. A lot of times credit cards, if you haven't used it in a year or more, they may just flat out close the card. So I mentioned this as another time that if you haven't, this would be a great time to really work on your credit score, check your credit score, see if there's ways to improve your credit score. Last but not least, make sure you have a credit score. Again, putting on my realtor hat right now, excuse me. I'm actually working with a client that's going to be a first-time home buyer and looking to close next week, but they're or her fiance has no credit score. Zilch. Not bad credit, not good credit, just zero credit. And Dave Ramsey says, oh, our credit score doesn't matter. Well, sorry, Dave, when it comes to that, you're kind of full of crap. Credit scores are important. Ask any lender. They will tell you having no credit is worse than having bad credit. And, you know, there's going to be a time in life that people are going to need funding. And nowadays, even credit scores, you know, they can tie into what you pay for car insurance or home insurance. And, you know, hate to say it, but there's even employers now that check credit reports as far as viability of candidates. And if it gets down to the wire between two good candidates, they may, you know, choose the one that has a higher credit score. You know, they can't discriminate against race or religion, but there's no protection classes put in place that deal with credit scores or credit ratings. So, you know, could obviously play into that. So maybe just as a final note for this podcast, as you are looking for your financial independence, your financial freedom day, if you're looking ahead, maybe see some storm clouds on the horizon. You know, are we going to enter a recession? Is unemployment going to go up? Are interest rates going to go up like they did in the 80s? Are we going to have stagflation from the 1970s? You know, what's to happen? You know, who knows? No one has a crystal ball. You know, this might be a good time to sit down, reflect, look at your income statement, look at your balance sheet, maybe restructure some debt, pay off some debt, and look at your credit score. If you have not ever or have not done that, you know, in a long time, now's probably the time. Banks are notorious for giving you offers when you don't need money. And when you need money, they will take it away. I think Warren Buffett said a banker is someone that'll give you an umbrella when the sun's out, but will ask for it back when it's raining. Very high level for credit, and might do a podcast or a video on this later. If you have a low credit score, no credit score, very high level, pay your bills on time, always, every time, even if it's just the minimum payment. Every bank and credit card I know of has the option to set up auto pay, that you can set up the auto pay for the minimum payment on or before the due date, month in and month out like clockwork. You never need to worry about mailing in a check or submitting a payment online ever again. That is the biggest thing that contributes to your credit score. Push for an average length of credit history to be at least 5+ years. If you have credit cards that you're looking at closing, you might want to, you know, double check to see how long you've had those open. If you've had a credit card, let's just say, I'll just keep it simple. If you got two credit cards and one you've had for 10 years and one you've had for 2 years, well, if you add 10 years plus 2 years divided by the two accounts, that gives you an average credit history of 6 years, which isn't bad. That's past the 5-year cutoff that a lot of lenders like to see. However, if you decide, well, I'm going to close one of these credit cards because I haven't used it, or back to like what I said, haven't used a certain credit card for over a year and the bank closes it, well, maybe it's the one that was open for 10 years. So now instead of two credit cards, you have one credit card, and that one credit card you've only had for 2 years. Well, you might not even owe anything on those credit cards. You're like, well, I pay my balance on time. I, you know, never have any late fees or anything like that. Well, you went from two cards to one. You had a average credit history of 6 years. Well, now with the 10-year card gone that was closed, now your history or your average credit history length dropped from 6 years down to 2. Again, we're back to that last year or last credit card, excuse me. and that will hit your credit score. Length of history is another kind of on the median level for what affects your FICO score. And probably one last piece of advice too, for all your credit cards, your revolving credit limit or lines, try to keep those at 29% debt to limits across the board if you can. Easy numbers, if you have a credit card that has a $10,000 limit, a 29% or lower would be $2,900 balance on that credit card. Again, this just goes back to all the algorithms of how FICO calculates the score and the reliability and responsibility of the borrower based on their credit history and habits. If that credit card is maxed out, that tends to lower your score. You know, back to a little bit of a hack here. If you have a credit card of $10,000 and you have a $5,000 balance on, and you say, well, geez, John, times are tough. I just can't make more than minimum payment. Okay, call up your bank. Maybe have them run your credit report again. Maybe your income's changed. Say, hey, I got a $10,000 limit. What can I qualify for now? Well, if you got a $10,000 credit card limit, you got a $5,000 balance on it, you go to the bank, and I've done this numerous times since I've been 18 when I first got my credit card. And they say, hey, you've been a great borrower. You've been with us for years. You've had no late payments. You've had a salary increase. You've paid off some debt, yada, yada, yada. Hey, instead of a $10,000 limit, we're going to raise you to $20,000 limit. Now, that's not a permission slip to go out and say, all right, I'm going to buy, you know, $10,000 worth of Bitcoin, lick movie, concert tickets, whatever the case may be. No. But again, it's a mathematical equation. $5,000 balance on a $10,000 limit card is a 50% debt to limit ratio, which tends to knock your credit score a little bit, you know, ding it a little bit. If that limit gets raised to $20,000, but you still have the same $5,000 balance on it, well, $5,000 out of a $20,000 limit, now you're at 25% limit of your available credit. That's below the 29% kind of sweet spot. And overnight, you might see a huge jump on your credit score. You did not make any extra payments. You did not pay down any debt. You did not consolidate it. You literally just called the bank, say, hey, can I get a credit line increase? And shifted the numbers, lowered your ratios, increased your credit score. And like I said, that's just kind of one little credit card hack that I've learned over the years. Again, try to keep all revolving credit lines to about 29% or less. That's kind of the magic number that FICO likes to see and might be the difference between getting a 680 FICO score and a 720. 740 is kind of like the max you can shoot for kind of getting the best rates. It's not like you're going to get a percent less interest rate. 1% interest rate cut if you had an 800 credit score versus a 740 or something like that. So 720, 740 is kind of what to hit for. 680 is kind of the lower limit of good credit, so to speak. Once you get into the low 600s and God forbid the 550 to 600s, then you're starting to pay higher interest rates, might be denied for credit. And again, could play a part into, if you get application in for a new rental that you're looking at, or, you know, even a job application or what you pay for insurance rates. So sorry, Dave Ramsey, credit scores do matter. Your advice is a little outdated and, you know, we live in different times than you did back in 1980 when you dealt with a lot of crushing debt and filed for bankruptcy. So credit scores do matter as we're looking into, shall we say, uncertain times. Look at your financial statement, look at your income statement, restructure some debt, pay off some debt, do some credit hacks, like I mentioned, work on your credit score, and just get yourself well positioned for storms that come up, but then also opportunities. If opportunity comes along of an investment property or whatever the case may be, and you need to act on it now, then you have the flexibility, you have the credits, you have the resources at your disposal to take action. That I'll close on this week's podcast. Hope you learned something from this. Like I said, I just kind of want to take a little different direction, kind of a recap of everything that's going on year to date here in 2022, and just some other tips and ideas that I've picked up along on my financial journey. So with that, I'll be closing this podcast. Be sure to hit that subscribe button for next week's episode, and I will be back to you with more information and more resources to help in your pursuit of wealth and freedom. Take care.
Thank you for listening. Be sure to share, rate, review, and subscribe on your favorite podcast platform. For more updates, check out www.wealthandfreedomnexus.com. Remember, nothing on this show should be considered tax, legal, investment, or professional advice. This show is produced solely for educational and informational purposes. Please consult an appropriate and licensed tax, legal, real estate, or business professional for specific advice for your situation. For distribution or publication rights or media interviews, please contact the host.